Welcome to The Investing Show, where we discuss ideas to help you make more of your money. I'm Simon Lambert of This Is Money. Joining me in the studio today, I've got David Coombs of Rathbones and Richard Hunter of Interactive Investor.
Simon.
David, you are a multi-asset fund manager, and that's a term that I don't doubt that our viewers and listeners will see plenty of. But what does it actually mean for them?
Well, we own more than one asset class, I suppose. In the sense that we have a totally unconstrained mandate. So I have to generate a return. One of my funds, for example, it's inflation plus 5% on an annualized basis. But I have the full suite, if you like, of asset classes in which to invest to try and achieve that return. So if equity markets are good value, we can have more of a leaning to equities. If bonds are good value, or government bonds, etc., we can have more of a leaning there, or commodities, property. Having that sort of lack of constraint means that you haven't got to sort of have a bias or focus in one asset class. You can literally go anywhere, anytime to try and generate those returns.
And obviously you have a great deal more resources at your disposal than the everyday investor. But in a way that makes a multi-asset fund manager more akin to the everyday investor, because if you are an individual investor, you can invest in any asset as well, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything else in life. How do you narrow that down, right? Because, as you say, you've got the ultimate unconstrained universe of investments, and yet you somehow got to strip that down to a cohesive strategy. The way I look at it is looking across, to start with, the various different asset classes at headline level and saying, you know, I've got a limited amount of capital to invest, and just like anybody else watching this show, where do I get best bang for my buck? I mean, it's not very technical, but That's what I do, you know. Don't waste capital on asset classes that I don't think are either going to generate the return that I need or offset the risk to reduce the risk of the portfolio. So whereas some multi-asset managers will have an exposure to all asset classes, I don't. I will only allocate to asset classes that actually either generate that return that I talked about or have some other role in the portfolio or strategy to sort of limit the downside.
So when you've got a specific target, such as inflation plus X percent, does that mean that, by definition, a lot of the assets you're investing in are sort of tending towards a higher end of the risk scale, for example?
No, and I think this is a really important point. You know, the way the industry's moved over the last few years is to say that risk is a bad thing. And I think we're still kind of getting over the hangover of 2007, 2008, and everyone's expecting a repeat crisis of some kind where we see 30% down or 40% down or even 50% down. Risk isn't a bad thing in investment terms, particularly if you've got a long time horizon, savers. Risk is actually a good thing. And higher risk, it's not high risk, extreme risk. Higher risk is okay. Okay. Inflation plus five, if you think about the UK equity market, it's achieved inflation plus four or five over the last 120, 130 years, obviously not every year. And that's where that target comes from. It's trying to achieve a return like the UK equity market, which most people can understand. They know it goes up, goes down, it's quite volatile, but that's the kind of return. Now that's the FTSE 100, that's blue chip equities. Mm. Is that high risk? Well, the industry says so now, 100% equities is higher risk. I'm not sure that's true. It's certainly higher risk if you've only got 2 to 3 year time horizon. If you've got a 20 to 30 year time horizon, that's not higher risk to me. So what I try to do is put risk in perspective and take each of my funds has a different time horizon. And I have higher risk investments in all of my funds, but it's the proportion that you have in each fund that drive the ultimate outcome that those investors get. But I am a risk taker. That's what I do. Going back to the earlier question, it's only take the risk that you need to and where you're actually getting paid for it and leave everything else alone.
And when you find yourself investing in that way at the moment, what do you find yourself leaning towards? Obviously, things are going to change depending on which particular fund you're aiming at and how much return you're aiming for. But what are the sort of principles when you look at those main asset classes, the shares, bonds, property, for example, that you see at the moment?
So, for me, investment can be made to look very complex, but ultimately, the core of each strategy right now is in equities to generate the returns. Because if you look at what equity markets have returned over the long term, it's 10% or higher in certain overseas markets. And that's what one should expect from your equity investments. There are very few other asset classes, mainstream asset classes, that generate those returns. Now, lots of people agonize over, is the market expensive today or tomorrow or last year, whatever. But if you just take a step back, if you've got a 30-year time horizon, the valuation today is not so important. Okay, so equities at the moment are the biggest part of how we invest. And within equities, we are most invested in companies that have high growth potential in sort of new technologies and in new global trends that we may come on to later. They're quite expensive companies. Now, a lot of people would say, well, that's higher risk, again, to your point, because they're expensive companies, therefore they're higher valued. But the reason they're expensive is that the market can see their earnings further into the future. In my view, that makes them less risky because their earnings are much more transparent and sustainable, whereas a lot of companies that people say are cheaper, therefore less risky, often their earnings outlook is less certain. Think Marks and Spencers, think some of the other retailers on the high street. They might be cheap stocks, high yields, but the future earnings are less obvious. If they're cheaper, does that make them less risk? I would argue no. Because their future earnings are less transparent. We don't know what's going to happen. So my equity portfolio has lots of kind of more expensive companies, but where there's high potential for growth. I think that's actually less risky in this environment.
Going on to the theme that you touched on there, you talked about technology, digital trends, companies, I guess, that are getting this thing right. I was reading a story the other day, 30 years since the advent of the World Wide Web, that Tim Berners-Lee had written something.
Yes.
And then if I think back 20 years, that's roughly when I got my first email account. I mean, the internet is unrecognisable from 20 years ago. And actually what we do with it digitally in terms of phones in our hands is unrecognisable from a decade ago even. Mm. So this is we're only very near the start of this period, it seems. And you said that you're looking for companies that can capitalise on this. What do you mean by that, and what do you want them to be doing?
So if we go back to dot-com mania, do you remember the late 90s? Lots of companies got huge ratings and valuations because they were seen as tech companies. And how many of those are there still today? How many of them failed? Hence we had the bust, right? Dot-com boom, dot-com bust. The companies that made, some of the companies that made the most money from the internet were companies like Amazon that arguably isn't a tech company anyway. It's a retail company it's the high street, right? The digital high street. So when I talk about investing in technology and digital companies embrace digital or have a digital strategy, what we're really talking about here is e-commerce and investing in companies that embrace e-commerce. Now that could be a tech company, but it could be a retail company. It could be a manufacturing company. It's those companies that see the opportunities that digital technology brings, whether it's AI, whether it's robotics, whatever that might be, marketing, targeted marketing, personal marketing, it's those companies that embrace the technology and improve their output or their profit margins. That's what I'm interested in. Yes, and some of those companies may be the ones providing it. What I don't mean by that is investing lots of startups, blue sky thinking type companies. That's a specialism for venture capital funds and private equity funds and startups and technology funds, should I say. I mean invest in the companies that are enabled by the technology. But the other point is that many companies embrace new technology but screw it up, actually. And the market is very excited because they embrace technology. Oh, isn't that fantastic? And yet they don't use it wisely. We can maybe talk about some of those examples in a second. And the obvious one that most people watching this would understand is when they go to the supermarket and use an automated machine and they lose the will to live. It says unidentified item in bagging area. That's a great example of where companies have embraced technology to the detriment of the customer experience. So just investing in digital isn't about just investing in digital. It's investing in companies that use that digital, improve the customer experience, and improve returns to shareholders. And the two are equally important.
It almost seems that you were describing there a spectrum that these companies sit on. You'll have, at one end, we've got the companies who really just don't do anything digitally.
Mm.
And then in the middle, you've got most companies who are doing what they need to do, maybe doing some of it okay, maybe not doing some of it that great, but yep. They're trundling along. And then at the far end, you've got the companies that are really embracing it to push their business forwards.
Yes, so let me use an example. So US Bank Corp is a company that we own, and I met in Minneapolis last year. And when they talk about an e-commerce or digital strategy, I mean, everyone talks about digital strategy, but no one actually knows what a digital strategy is. What is a digital strategy? Everyone could, it's a subjective term. And what I came to learn from digital strategies, it isn't just about buying kit or a few extra sensors or clever stuff or smart this or smart that. US Bank Corp discovered that they need to improve the customer experience to attract more customers from the big four banks in the States. And how do they do that? Well, one thing they noticed was, for example, millennials were using branches more often than their parents did, which was quite interesting because, you know, most of us think millennials don't leave their bedrooms very often, you know. But actually, and you'd think they would do everything online, but what the banks found in the States was it was the opposite. Millennials didn't trust signing up to financial services online and preferred to meet actual human beings like us. So US Bank Corp have started increasing their investment into branches, quite different to what we're seeing over in the UK right now. And their branches are changing the way that they're used and becoming more like showrooms than the old-fashioned bank branches that we remember. But on top of that, they develop an app that allows the customers much greater experience as well. So, for example, if you want to buy a second-hand car, their app will tell you where you can find that car in your local location and approve the car loan whilst you drive over to the showroom. So the turnaround on getting approval for loans is that much quicker and digital, and you haven't got to speak to anybody, it's done automatically. So their e-commerce strategy is twofold. It's the analog solution, if you like, investing more in branches and putting more people into branches, okay? And then secondly, developing the software and the app that actually makes a difference. If you just develop an app to show your bank account, that's just a hygiene factor. It's what extra are you bringing by integrating that into your proposition. It's subtle, but it's really, really important. It's where IT spend is effective. Go back to my supermarket experience, where the IT spend has made it worse for the customer and actually drives down revenues rather than increases them.
So how much local knowledge would you need of the culture, for example, or are you simply impressed by the bank or experience? And by that, I mean that millennial description you've just given doesn't necessarily translate to the UK at the moment. You'd probably have a better feel for the rest of Europe, for example.
Well, the US, the way people interact with financial advisors, for example, is a different model in the States. People tend to use the banks more than independents that they do in the UK. But I think if you think about the excitement around fintech and Nutmeg was launched a couple of years ago, and that's struggled And I think we all get very excited again about what does AI mean, financial services and fintech, and everyone's going to do everything online. And then I think what US Bank Corp kind of reminded me is that people still trust people. They don't necessarily want to talk to chatbots. You know, we own a company called Discover, one of the biggest credit card companies in the US. And their kind of unique selling point, if you like, is that if you ring them up for whatever reason, a human being answers the phone rather than an automated operator. I mean, hallelujah, right? You know, having spent an hour on the phone to John Lewis this week. You know, so someone picks up the phone within 25 seconds and it's a human being who lives in the same country as you. People value that, okay, as a customer experience. That's part of their e-commerce strategy, is that actually we recognise that a lot of e-commerce really upsets customers. They still want to deal with human beings. So I think what US Bank Corp has, that meeting taught us, is that we need to sort of take a step back and not get carried away sometimes these trends and fashions, and it all gets a bit trendy in investment circles as well. It's all a rush to automation. No, it's about effective use of automation to get rid of all the sort of the mundane, if you like, but remembering that people still value people and they don't want chat bots. They don't want automated Q&As or voice recognition. You know, I rang up the other day and said, I've got a problem with something, and they said, tell, you know, the computer says, tell me what it is. You tell them what it is, and it wasn't one of the five things it was recognizing, right? I mean, how frustrating is that? And I think that's the key. So when I look at all the companies in the portfolio, when we talk to the management, it's, I want to see that the customer is seen as important as the shareholder. Not everything is focused on the shareholder. Many investment managers want to think shareholder value should be the number one priority. In my view, if the shareholders put too far above the customer, which I would argue is a very important stakeholder, those companies tend to struggle.
going back to the retail element that you talked about there, where obviously that's where people and as customers end up dealing with a business face to face all the time.
Yeah.
Are there any retailers that you think are doing this particularly well?
I mean, this is not an invested security, I'm not even sure it's listed, but I went into Moulton and Brown the other day where they have sinks where people can actually try out their products in the shop. You know, bringing customer experience to the, rather than just a shop full of shelves and an annoying, you know, shop hand saying, can I help you every 2 seconds? Okay, that's not great, that's pressure. We own Ulta Beauty, again, it's a US company, US specialty retail in sort of cosmetics and beauty products where there's loyalty clubs and there are, you go in and have an experience and have your makeup done and all this. Not obviously a big area for me personally as a consumer, I'll be honest, but it's about the experience going into the shop. It's a day out, it's, you know, it, you look forward to it. It's not just going into to Boots and taking some lipstick off the shelf. So I think they're good examples of retailers who are starting to get it. And you look at John Lewis's struggle, for example, where they used to be relied on for customer service and then try to deal with price. I come back to my e-commerce point. You can't compete on price anymore very easily. That only ends badly in lower revenue, lower profits. You've got to try and maintain your pricing by offering the customer that little bit more. And that's an experience. It's part of a day out. And whereas the British public loved going for a day out shopping in the past, now they expect more than just walking from shop to shop comparing prices. They can do that on the internet. Now when they go shopping, they want to have something a bit more. And there are some retailers that you're starting to see, Nike's another one, where the retail experience is more about entertainment, not just about selling units.
It may just be coincidence, but the companies you mentioned so far that you are invested in have all come from the States. Mm. Presumably, you've got a rather more global view with the same principle.
So, yeah, I'm kind of agnostic where a company is listed, to be honest with you. We can invest globally. We find more of those types of companies in the US. I know it's a cliche, but you too tend to find that US management are a little bit further ahead. They probably haven't got distractions of Brexit, for example. I mean, you know, Amazon's a US company and Google, et cetera, so that those competitors were in the States earlier and companies have had to adjust to the threat of being disintermediated by these big online challenges. So you do feel they're a couple of years ahead in terms of coming to... And as I said, when I went to the States, I saw companies in all sorts of sectors, from making pumps to selling taps to on a business-to-business basis, all of them were thinking about how do we make sure we don't lose business to just an online operator? How do we deal with that? You don't feel yet the UK is caught up. Marks and Spencer's starting to look at it with, you know, the Ocado purchase. Is that right? I don't know. But I don't know. I just find the US, more companies, there's a capital discipline there. And obviously they've got one big market on their doorstep, which gives them an advantage and scale, which in Europe... companies have a much more fragmented market across Europe, despite the EU even year before. So I think US companies have a slight example. Capital discipline in the States tends to be, by and large, you know, dangerous to generalise, but tends to be better. But yes, we have European companies in the portfolio, and dare I say it, a few UK companies in the portfolio, like Hargreaves Lansdown, which I think is a great example of a British company that's very forward-thinking and innovative and absolutely looks at the client interface. And have, I think, you know, market leader. So there are some good examples in the UK and Europe. But at the moment, I think China and the US lead the way.
And ultimately, I guess it comes down to the fact that there's an awful lot of companies in the world, and if you're only going to be picking a relatively small number of them to go into your fund, you can afford to be pretty choosy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm only looking for 40 to 50. You know, I'm not an equity fund manager who's trying to outperform every 3 months, so I can take a longer term view. You can only look after and be comfortable with so many, and it's much easier if you have a certain level of criteria that you focus on. And right now, for me, the threat of e-commerce and the huge transformation that, let's face it, none of us know exactly what that looks like over the next 5 years, other than there's going to be quite a big transformation. Typically AI and virtual reality, etc. I'm trying to find those companies that, that's a horrible term, but future-proofed, if you like, that have got the flexibility, have got the management teams that have shown they're willing to change and adapt, who are more likely to be able to navigate their way through this change that's coming. Is there any guarantees? No. You know, I don't need to own the best 150 companies in the world. I don't even need to own the best 50 companies in the world. But I need to own the 50 companies that are going to generate those returns I talked about at the start of the show and aren't too risky, i.e. strong balance sheets, not amount of debt. Because ultimately, it's debt that tends to undermine companies if they haven't got that growth that's sustainable.
So, I mean, some of those companies that you're describing, perhaps not the US ones who are traditionally lower dividend payers, but presumably some of the companies that are in your portfolio are going to have a reasonably high yield. Is that dividend reinvestment time?
So dividend yield's interesting. It's very much a UK phenomenon, isn't it? We're kind of focused on dividends, which we don't have elsewhere, partly due to tax, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing that worries me at the moment, and I don't have many high-yielding dividend stocks, to your point, and I certainly don't target them, and a good example has been Marks Spencer, actually, which just cut its dividend, rightly, I might say, because I think we talked about not being constrained, but if you're a company with a high dividend yield and your top 20 shareholders are income funds or pension funds, then you, as a management team, you are quite constrained because the world is changing fast and the way to adapt to that change is to invest. But if you can't get your hands on sufficient capital because you've got to maintain a high dividend payout, that constrains you from change, as Marx have found. And so I think there are a number of companies in the UK which have got very high dividend yields that probably should be cutting them, actually. Now, the trouble with that is, you do that, those top 20 shareholders who are in there for income are probably going to sell you. And you know, no CEO wants to see their share price fall 25% before bonus time, right? So you are in this loop of short-term, three-month reviews of company results, etc., with companies with high dividend yields, where the CFO's thinking, you know, because who says that the capital in the investor's hands is better than what the CEO can do? Because that's always the dilemma, isn't it? Can the management make more of the capital that the company raises than giving it to us in our hands as dividends? And I think we've gone, in the UK particularly, the balance has maybe gone too much towards focusing on income, and the balance needs to readjust. And at the moment, some of those yields are so high, it kind of feels like the market agrees with me and saying those aren't sustainable dividend yields.
And of course, another way of shareholder returns is share buyback programs, which are pretty prevalent in the States as well. And there's always two arguments there. Does that mean that management can't find a better use for that capital? And by accounting purposes, also improving some of the metrics?
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. There's no point in a company storing cash that's, you know, 0.5%. You might as well pay it to us as dividends or share buybacks, as you say, and improve the overall the value of the capital. But that again, that's the dilemma. I mean, as a multi-asset manager targeting real returns, I'm kind of agnostic. I don't really care if it's income or capital. It's the full package, or it's a share buyback. It's whatever is appropriate for the company that you're invested in. As I said earlier, the companies I tend to invest in are still in growth sectors, whatever they may be, and therefore they are typically reinvesting that capital, so we'll have a pretty low dividend yield, actually.
Yeah. Gentlemen, that's all we've got time for. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us on The Investing Show. See you next time. Goodbye.